From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now! As India and Pakistan are poised for war, we'll talk about the level of destruction a nuclear confrontation could mean. This as a new movie comes out in the United States talking about a nuclear explosion here.
If you strike against the Russians, you sacrifice your moral authority.
We have reason to believe the bomb was the work of terrorists, not the Russians.
Get him.
Mr. President, they're scrambling the fighters.
My orders are to get the right information to the people who make the decision.
Put it in your report.
And if you shut me out, your family and 25 million other families will be dead.
We'll talk with a doctor from International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, and then we'll look at Israel sweeping across the West Bank. A conversation with Palestinian journalist Daoud Kutab fighting for a free media in Palestine. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Russian President Vladimir Putin is heading international efforts to arrange a face-to-face meeting between the leaders of India and Pakistan at a regional security conference in Kazakhstan. Russia is a major supplier of arms to India. Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf says he wants dialogue, but India has flatly ruled out talks at any level until Pakistan stops incursions into the Indian-controlled Kashmir. In one hopeful sign, a senior Indian government official is quoted in today's press as saying India has intercepted communications from militant groups, which suggests they have received an order from Pakistan to halt incursions. Meanwhile, the Bush administration has urged the 60,000 Americans now in India to leave immediately. Britain and France have also told its citizens to leave, and the United Nations is evacuating the families of its staff. India's war secretary said over the weekend his army has a moral and legal right to attack Pakistan. He said the Indian government is actively considering so-called surgical strikes and said the army could strike at 3 hours' notice. President Bush dramatically repudiated the Cold War policies of deterrence and containment in a speech this weekend. He said the U.S. must take so-called preemptive action against potential enemies. Speaking at West Point's graduation, Bush said the U.S. must be prepared to take the so-called war on terror to up to 60 countries. The White House billed the speech as the first part of a new overall security framework. The CIA tracked two of the September 11th hijackers more than a year and a half before September 11th. Newsweek is reporting the CIA tracked two suspected terrorists to an Al-Qaeda summit in Malaysia in January 2000, then looked on as they re-entered the U.S. and began preparations for September 11th. The CIA had said previously it hadn't learned of Khalid al-Midar's connections to Al-Qaeda until the month before the hijackings. The agency did not tell either immigration officials or the FBI. The movements of the men could have been monitored easily as they lived openly in the U.S., apparently under their real names. The two reportedly took flying lessons in San Diego, where their instructor later said they were only interested in flying big jets. Israel troops raided a West Bank refugee camp today and arrested hundreds of Palestinians. Tanks surrounded the Ein Bet Ilma refugee camp near the West Bank city of Nablus as jeeps and armored personnel carriers drove through the main street. Troops using loudspeakers called on all males between the ages of 15 and 50 to come out of their homes. The Washington Post is reporting some 400 men were taken away in buses. The army barred foreign journalists from entering, but over a dozen international peace activists managed to get inside. Many of them have now been arrested. The U.S. is blocking an international plan to cut in half the number of people who have no sanitation. Two-fifths of the world's population, some 2.4 billion people, lack even a bucket for their waste. This is one of the main causes of world disease. Countries from around the world are meeting in Bali, Indonesia, in the final preparatory conference for the World Summit for Sustainable Development, which will convene in August in Johannesburg. International diplomats are baffled at the Bush administration's position. Meanwhile, in a stark shift for the Bush administration, the United States has sent a climate report to the United Nations detailing specific and far-reaching effects that it says global warming will inflict on the American environment. In the report, the administration for the first time mostly blames human actions for recent global warming. It says the main culprit is the burning of fossil fuels that send heat-trapping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. But while the report says the United States will be substantially changed in the next few decades, it does not propose any major shift in the administration's policy on greenhouse gases. The U.S. government will resume making plutonium triggers for nuclear warheads and is beginning design work on a $2 to $4 billion manufacturing plant. Currently, the Energy Department relies on refurbishing triggers from disassembled warheads when they're needed, but officials say that limited production capability can't meet long-term needs. The debate is still taking place on how to dispose of the thousands of old pits removed from dismantled nuclear weapons. Meanwhile, Senate Majority Whip Harry Reid has called for an ethics investigation into Energy Undersecretary Robert Card. Reid wants to know if Card violated conflict of interest rules and federal law by acting to benefit two nuclear waste companies where he once was a high-ranking official. And a federal appeals court on Friday struck down a 30-year-old ban that keeps protesters from the House and Senate entrances of the Capitol. A three-judge panel unanimously agreed that U.S. Capitol Police regulations violate the right of protesters to gather on the sidewalk on the east side of the Capitol and pass out leaflets or hold signs. The judges ruled that security concerns do not outweigh First Amendment rights at a building that is, quote, a centerpiece of our democracy. And a federal court panel Friday struck down a law requiring libraries to filter the internet for material harmful to minors. The court said the technology blocks so much unobjectionable material that it would violate the First Amendment rights of people who use the internet at the library.
Millions of people around the world say no to nuclear war. As the powers that be keep destroying the earth, we are joined by a million more. Good for the world for turning out. Good for the world for turning out. Good for the world for turning out. When we turn out, it's good for the world. We get tired and feeling weary and can't find an open door. Youngest child, and let your spirit soar. Good for the world for hanging on. Good for the world for hanging on. Good for the world for hanging on. When we hang on, it's good for the world. The world is full of lovers and
Good for the World by Holly Neer and Jeff Langley here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Russian President Vladimir Putin is heading international efforts to arrange a face-to-face meeting between the leaders of India and Pakistan at a regional security conference in Kazakhstan. Russia is a major supplier of weapons to India. The Pakistani president, General Pervez Musharraf, says he wants dialogue. India's flatly refused to talk at any level until Pakistan stops incursions into the Indian-controlled Kashmir. India's war secretary said over the weekend his army has a, quote, moral and legal right to attack Pakistan. He said the Indian government is actively considering so-called surgical strikes and said the army could strike at 3 hours' notice. The Bush administration urged the 60,000 Americans now in India to leave immediately. Britain, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, France, Belgium, Israel, and South Korea have also issued similar warnings to their own nationals living in India, and the United Nations is evacuating the families of its staff. We turn now to Dr. Mary Wynne Ashford, who is co-president of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
In the last few years, you've met with the Indian Prime Minister as well as high-level Pakistani officials. Can you talk about the level of the threat, of the nuclear threat right now?
Well, it's certainly changed since we met with them. We met with them right after they had signed the Lahore Agreement, and things looked absolutely terribly optimistic because they said, we think we can resolve Kashmir in a matter of weeks or short months.
Can you explain what the
things have really deteriorated? That was 1999.
And what the Lahore Agreement was?
The Lahore Agreement basically said that they renounced the use of force and that they would deal with all outstanding issues between them by peaceful means. So that was the first time that the Prime Minister of India had crossed the border into Pakistan by bus and into Lahore and met there with the then Prime Minister of Pakistan, President of Pakistan. So things now are at an extreme level of tension and instability, and I think that the various countries that have asked their nationals to withdraw are absolutely correct. I think the risk of nuclear war is higher than it's been at any time since the Cuban crisis in the 1960s.
What do you think needs to be done right now?
Well, the first thing is that both countries have to agree to an immediate ceasefire, and they have to back off their million troops that are facing each other across the line of control. They have to go back to where they were with the numbers in early December before all of this current business started. And I think it's important that there be a back down in the rhetoric that is demanding that President Musharraf of Pakistan control all of the cross-border incursions. Now, I'm not saying that he shouldn't be doing that. He certainly should be doing that. But by blaming him for all of those actions, the Indian government is actually shifting the control of this whole situation into the hands of the extremist terrorists. Because if they then ignore Musharraf's commands and do a suicide bombing or an attack onto the Indian side, Musharraf is blamed, and there's a tremendous risk that his government can fall. If his government falls, there is a large Taliban population in Pakistan, a large number of extremists, and nuclear weapons. And that's the recipe for absolute catastrophe.
We're talking to Dr. Mary Wynn Ashford, co-president of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. Who armed India and Pakistan?
Well, I mean, the whole world has armed India and Pakistan. Russia has been allied with India and China with Pakistan, but they get arms all over the place. Originally, as far as the nuclear issue was concerned, it was Canada that sold a nuclear reactor to India, and India used that technology to go ahead and develop the bomb in the 1970s. And then, since then, both countries had been developing nuclear weapons, because by the time India tested their weapons most recently, in 1998, Pakistan was ready to respond with their tests in just a few short months after that. So those things had been in progress for several years at that point.
If we're talking about a nuclear confrontation, what would that mean in terms of casualties?
Well, first of all, if both sides use missiles, it's less than 6 minutes from one country to the other. So there is essentially no warning. And if, say, you were in India and you saw that a missile was coming in from Pakistan, you might decide to fire in retaliation before it even landed, because otherwise you risk losing the missiles that you've got. If you do that and that was a computer error or a mistake, then you have begun a nuclear holocaust. If one country uses a ground blast, that causes much, much more radioactivity than if the blast is in the air. So if, for example, one of these weapons was put in a truck and somehow got to the other side and was exploded at ground level, all of the dirt and the soil and the carbon and the soot would become radioactive, would rise up into the air, be carried on the wind, and come down elsewhere as black rain. And that carries the radiation that causes radiation illness. So in the center, the very center of a nuclear blast, essentially everything is vaporized. The people, the trees, the cars, everything is vaporized for about a half mile. And then out from that, for about 8 miles, you have blast damage that knocks down everything except reinforced concrete buildings, explodes all of the gasoline stations and the car gas tanks. All of the people receive third-degree burns, which are lethal unless you have a very high-class burn unit to deal with them. And as you go further out, you get the injuries that come from the firestorm, because as these fires start, they suck up all of the oxygen, leaving behind a vacuum that brings in winds of hurricane force, knocking over anything that can move. So people are thrown against, you know, remaining debris or windows, broken windows and so on, and get those injuries while at the same time receiving radiation injuries. Then out beyond that, all the way out to about 30 miles away, if you were to turn and look at the flash of a nuclear explosion, you would be permanently blinded. So this is a horror that the people in, particularly the people in Pakistan, are not aware of to the extent that we have been in North America. And the reason that they're not aware of it is that they've not received the education. Many, many of them are illiterate. Few speak English. And the materials that we put out as doctors are primarily distributed in English and Urdu, but they don't reach the population who can't read. And this stuff does not come out on their television sets to say, this is what it would mean. If there's a nuclear blast on one side and that side retaliates, how many bombs will they exchange before they'll stop? 5, 10? You know, each one would cause hundreds of thousands of deaths immediately, because these bombs would be landing in cities that have enormously dense populations. So you'd have the hundreds of thousands who die immediately. Then you'd have the delayed deaths from radiation and from burns. And then after that, you'd have the deaths from the radioactive cloud. And the radioactive cloud would drift over the whole world. We'd have the same kind of experience that we had after Chernobyl of patches of radiation appearing everywhere in the Northern Hemisphere. So this is just an unimaginable tragedy. And to hear the kind of rhetoric where the leaders are saying, we're not willing to talk, it's absurd. I think sending Donald Rumsfeld is not nearly enough. I think that certainly Colin Powell should be there, probably Jimmy Carter, the Dalai Lama, Nelson Mandela. You know, we are facing an enormous catastrophe.
Dr. Mary Wynne Ashford of International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War. We're talking about the threat of nuclear war between India and Pakistan, fears of a nuclear attack also rising here in the U.S. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld helped set off panic when he warned recently that terrorists will soon obtain nuclear weapons and use them against the U.S. 3 days later, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission issued a warning telling more than 100 nuclear power plants to be alert for possible terrorist attacks by small planes. Then came The Sum of All Fears, the movie that opened this past week, a Hollywood blockbuster in which neo-Nazi terrorists detonate a nuclear bomb during the Super Bowl in Baltimore. In that case, in the movie, the bomb comes from the buried wreckage of an Israeli fighter jet that was shot down in 1973. Nomadic Bedouin discover the bomb in the desert 3 decades later. They sell the bomb to the neo-Nazis, who arrange to smuggle it into Baltimore Harbor in a cigarette vending machine. Maybe some of you have seen the movie, but this is an excerpt.
Hello, Kathy.
I can't make it.
Where are you going?
I can't tell you that, Jack.
Tell her where you're going. In fact, tell her who you work for. She'll be impressed.
I work for the CIA, and the director asked me at the last minute to come with him to Russia to do a nuclear arms inspection.
That is so lame.
Hello?
You're about to breathe air that's way over your pay grade, so listen up. You're going to be asked for analysis and advice, so be sure you know what you're talking about. Welcome to the CIA, sport.
At a time of increasing tension.
According to this, there are 17 senior scientists on duty today.
I only count 14.
Deliberate deception.
3 Russian scientists are missing. I need to know where they are.
Suit up. I don't go on the missions. I just write reports.
So write a report about it.
I'm an analyst.
I'm not trained for this.
Just be my eyes and ears.
I can't be with somebody who's going to keep their life hidden from me, Jack.
I will not let that happen.
And new enemies.
You don't fight Russia and America.
You get Russia and America to fight each other and destroy each other.
Only two men suspect the truth.
What's a South African doing in the Ukraine? Three Russian scientists.
And that is an excerpt of the movie, The Sum of All Fears. Ultimately, in the film, the blast decimates Baltimore and sets in motion a misunderstanding between the United States and Russia that builds towards nuclear war. Up to one man to clear up the confusion before the two sides hurtle into World War III. When we come back, we're going to talk to Jonathan Parfrey, who is Executive Director of Physicians for Social Responsibility, about the possibilities of something like this happening in the United States. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn to Jonathan Parfrey, Executive Director of Physicians for Social Responsibility, The Sum of All Fears is the movie of the day, the Hollywood blockbuster that stars Morgan Freeman and Ben Affleck that deals with the issue of a nuclear bomb being detonated in the United States. Also, I think the movie should be congratulated for not furthering standard stereotypes. In this case, Arabs are not the perpetrators. In fact, they are victims in this case, at least the Bedouin who find this nuclear device from a shot down Israeli plane. Also talking about the fear of neo-Nazi terror. But the question of could a nuclear bomb be detonated here, what do you think of the issue this raises?
Well, it's powerful to see the depiction of an atomic blast on American soil. And here it is 10 years after the end of the Cold War. And so many people thought, you know, that was it. We can celebrate. This is no longer going to be a problem. But it seems to be in the cultural zeitgeist right now that there's this fear that it's out there. And also the film, I think, did a very good job in showing how things can very quickly get out of control, that there are sort of military protocols that must be followed. And as JFK, you know, wrote in his memoirs around the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, he actually felt that things were even out of his hands, that he didn't have control over them. The film also showed the shoddy state of security at Russian facilities. And, you know, currently there's a program that is in need of great funding to secure a number of these former both nuclear, chemical, and biological facilities in Russia, and they're simply not being funded at the levels that they should be. I mean, when you have rows upon rows of artillery shells in southern Russia near the, near Chechnya, that have nerve gas agents in them, and they're being protected by a chain link fence and a bicycle lock, you know that there are additional steps that we need to take to protect ourselves.
And how about here, where these threats really are? There's a movement in New York to close down Indian Point nuclear power plant. And among the arguments are that, you know, New York City is, if it were ever to be blown up, to say the least, the city of New York could well be wiped out. What about this threat of nuclear power plants and the warning that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has just issued?
Well, you know, that when there was initially the thought of Pakistan developing nuclear weapons, there was the argument made to that country that they actually didn't need to develop nuclear weapons because India had nuclear power plants and they would simply have to bomb their power plants in order to have a retaliatory strike. you know, all these nuclear power plants across the United States, they provide a very high-level target. And one of the things that we are working on at Physicians for Social Responsibility, and we had a meeting yesterday at UCLA, which we jokingly referred to as our public health summit of all fears, where we did talk about nuclear power attacks. We talked about what would happen if there were a radiological weapon being used, and we talked about what would happen if there was a low-yield nuclear device detonated in downtown L.A. So, in essence, an attack on a nuclear power plant would have devastating consequences. There are the primary and secondary cooling systems, and if those cooling systems, for some reason, were shut off or taken out, the effects would be absolutely devastating, and likely the casualties would rank in the hundreds of thousands.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. We've been speaking with Jonathan Porfrey, Executive Director of Physicians for Social Responsibility. Finally, what do you think is the most important thing people can do right here in the United States?
You know, we believe that an ounce of prevention is worth a megaton of cure, and people need to be involved in a political movement to try to stop these things from happening. We cannot allow the issues of security to be left in the hands of the experts or the government officials. It is not a question of the military being able to provide security. We have to provide security for ourselves, and we have to do it through the wisdom of our democratic process.
Again, thank you, Jonathan Porfrey. Physician for Social Responsibility also co-chairs the Southern California Environmental Executives Roundtable. As we now turn to what's happening in the West Bank right now, Israeli troops raided a West Bank refugee camp today, arrested hundreds of Palestinians. Tanks surrounded the Ein Bet Yilma refugee camp near the West Bank city of Nablus as jeeps and armored personnel carriers drove through the main street. Troops using loudspeakers called on all males between the ages of 15 and 50 to come out of their homes. Troops smashed their way through the walls of houses and barred foreign journalists from entering. The Washington Post is reporting some 400 men were taken away in buses. Israeli-style, quote, security may come to the United States. 2 weeks ago, Israel's Shin Bet Security Service instructed a delegation from the New York Police Department on how to deal with suicide bombings. Law enforcement officials from Georgia, as well as Los Angeles, have traveled to Israel over the last several weeks for seminars on security and to study an Israeli paramilitary border police unit. Israel plans to host a convention of U.S. police commissioners sometime later this year. While Israel's security forces are widely reputed to be among the toughest in the world, not everyone in Israel agrees the country offers a model of how to reconcile security with democracy. Today we're joined by two people. Shlomo Dror is a spokesperson, has been a spokesperson for the Israeli Defense Ministry, and a spokesman for an Israeli government agency responsible for Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. He joined the Shin Bet, Israeli security force, 23 years ago and has been in charge of security for embassies and El Al airlines on three continents. Shortly after September 11th, Shlomo Dror joined with U.S. partners with experience in the Marines and CIA to form New World Security, which is a New York-based company that offers advice on securing buildings and air travel. We're also joined by Hashem Mahamid, who is a member of the Israeli Knesset with the Hadash Party, who has just come out of a Knesset meeting where a vote is taking place. Before we go to this issue of the Israeli Shin Bet and security training U.S. security, I wanted to ask Hashem Mahamid what's happening in Knesset right now.
Yes. Before I just tell you what's happening now, I used to be the head of Hadash, but now I'm part of the United Arab List in the Knesset. It's other list which ran to the Knesset in the last elections. Anyway, what's going now that we are asking the Knesset to vote against the Sharon government. But one thing is very obvious. that this government is going to go, is not going to fail. This government is very strong, with a very wide coalition of most Zionist parties in the Knesset. Maybe 100 members of the parliament do support this government, and Sharon has the popularity not only in the Knesset, but also in the Israeli street, within the Israeli people. And so what we are doing is just we are trying to protest. We are trying to raise some voice against the policy of this government on the many topics and issues, starting with the political issue and the conflict with the Palestinians, the continuation of occupation and oppression, and the economic, socio-economic problems in Israel, which are deteriorating from bad to worse.
Let's go to Shlomo Dror again, who has set up New World Security, coming from his Shin Bet, etc. background in Israel. Can you talk about the training that is going on of U.S. police by the Israeli military in Shin Bet?
Well, good morning, first of all. What I can say that Israel actually can provide to United States experience, because the United States have a lot of abilities. What we have is experience, mainly because that Israel became to be some kind of a laboratory for terrorist action. And what we see today in Israel can happen tomorrow in the United States. And actually, in the last 40 years, we live in a terror threat all the time. So what we have all the time is to learn how to deal with a terrorist, what kind of answer we can give, and how to help people continue their normal life.
Hashem Mahamid, can you talk about your reaction to the Israeli police military training U.S. police?
Well, it's very obvious that Israel is very strong within the Shin Bet and security actions. It is very strong. But one thing we have to remember, that no security in any part of the world without justice or some kind of part of a justice. And we can see that in Israel. I mean, I don't see any security for the people of Israel anywhere in Israel, because there is no security in the area. There is no security in the, there is no border at all for Israel in order to say, well, from this line on, it's ours, and from this line on, it's not ours. So it's, for my opinion, it's very impossible for any security forces to deal with the problem of, I want to differentiate between the resistance of people for their liberation and freedom, and of course, against terrorism. And I am saying that very loud. I'm against any act of terrorism which comes to kill or murder innocent people, including the suicide bombs inside Israel. I'm against this. But I'm saying that it's when we say that Israel is going to sell its experience to other countries, that reminds me of what is happening in some countries in Africa, where Israel sells arms to some regimes that are oppressing their peoples, like in Zimbabwe and other places. And so that I don't believe in selling or teaching other countries how to deal with security, because usually it is how to deal with oppression of other minorities or other parts of the world or other peoples who want to be free or who are looking for democracy.
Shlomo Dror, your response.
I hope that Tasha Mahmoud doesn't say that United States really occupied Arabs or Al-Qaeda people or something like that. Well, I think that there is a threat against United States citizens, and I don't see any border between the United States and Afghanistan, and still the people from Al-Qaeda attacked New York and the other places, and I'm sure that they will continue to do it. So I don't think that you can find some connection between what's happening in Israel and what's happening in the United States from this context. But the only thing that we can say that we live in a terror threat all the time, and the Israeli Secret Service and the Shin Bet, of course, they managed to stop most of the terror attacks. We spoke about 40 attacks for in the last few weeks. And, of course, the headline is when the terrorists manage to kill many people, but in most of the cases we manage to stop them, and we are trying to provide the people in Israel to live their life. It's not very easy because, of course, we have a lot of terror attacks here and a lot of threats, but that's what we are trying to give our people. In the United States, the situation is different.
Let me ask, Hashem Mahamid has been quoted in the Christian Science Monitor as saying Palestinian civilians need to prepare for their graves when they approach Israeli checkpoints. I don't think the practices in the West Bank and Gaza are something Americans can take pride in. What about your response to that, Shlomo Dror?
Well, I think that we have to look at the fact. There are so many checkpoints. There are so many Palestinians going through this checkpoint. How many Palestinians killed in this checkpoint? You will ask yourself, we are speaking about a small number of people that killed at the checkpoint, and usually it's people who try to run away. And in many cases, not far from my house, a woman blew herself up in a checkpoint. I'm living very close to the Green Line, and a Palestinian woman blew herself up, and she tried to kill the soldiers over there. And that's maybe Hashem Mahamid doesn't count, but there is a threat, and the soldiers at that checkpoint, they are under threat as well. And they try to behave as the best way that it's possible, but again, in the United States, you don't need that kind of checkpoint. And we are speaking about different security, like security in airlines, security in for companies.
Hashem Mahamid, your response.
Let me say I'm not against security for innocent people. I mean, let people who are listening to us understand that I'm very rational in this way. But I'm against supplying any kind of supplies or teaching all these dictatorships, including what I mentioned before, Zimbabwe and other places in Africa where Israel sells this experience, these dictatorships. Now, about America and what happened on the 11th of September, I'm very clear, of course, it's obvious that I'm against those acts. I'm not defending Al-Qaeda. I spoke about Israel, and I must relate to that and say that it is impossible, and to say to my friend from the Shin Bet, it is impossible to bring security when, and I want security to everybody, but you cannot bring security when you are oppressing 3.5 million Palestinians.
On that note, I have to thank you both very much for being with us as we go to our break. Hashem Mahamid, a member of the Knesset with the Hadash Party, Palestinian, and Shlomo Dror, Israeli security specialist and founder of the new U.S.-based New World Security. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back with Juan Gonzalez and Palestinian reporter Daoud Kutab in a minute.
Yeah. Welcome back to Democracy Now! The new director of the Israel Broadcasting Authority, Joseph Barrel, banned the use of the term settlers from the airwaves late last week. The instructions to editors came after the Environmental Affairs Minister told Barrel he should put an end to the frequent use of the term settler in the IBA's radar and television broadcast. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting that Israel has laid the foundations for some 40 new settlements in the past few months alone. Independent reporter Robert Fisk says that even the words settler and settlement are propaganda. More accurate descriptions are colonizer and colony. We're joined today by Daoud Kutab, a Palestinian journalist who has spent his life fighting for a free media in Palestine. Kutab has a long history of fighting censorship by the Israeli authorities. He was the first Palestinian to conduct interviews with Israeli leaders like Yitzhak Rabin and Shimon Peres while reporting for the Arabic language daily Al-Quds in the early 90s. Kutab was repeatedly arrested and searched by the Israeli authorities for participation in public demonstrations against Israeli press censorship. In 1994, Yasser Arafat ordered Al-Quds to stop publishing Kutab's columns after he led independent journalists in a protest against the banning of Al-Nahar, Jerusalem's only other Arabic language daily at the time. Al-Quds gave in and fired Kutab, but he refused to be silenced. He continued to write critical pieces for the international press, including the New York Times and the Washington Post. But his battle against censorship is an ongoing, never-ending one. During the occupation of Ramallah in April, Israeli forces took over Al-Quds Educational Television, a project of the Institute of Modern Media at Al-Quds University in Jerusalem that Kutab heads. They took the station off the air and destroyed hundreds of thousands of dollars in equipment before they left. So welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Tell us a little bit about this latest situation during the occupation of Ramallah. What precisely happened to your station? And also tell our listeners a little bit about what the station broadcasts.
We are an educational television station that tries to mimic, if you will, PBS and C-SPAN and BBC, in the sense that we try to do public service broadcasting. We film and broadcast public events, and we do a number of community-type programs. Children's programs, issues of gender are very high on our priority list. And, of course, on the democratic discussions about civil society, we are among the leaders there in Palestine. And we conduct political discussions of all the different forums in Palestine. So we cover all these issues. And we belong to a university, and our university building was taken over on April 3rd by Israeli soldiers, and they literally kicked out our guard, our broadcasters, and they took over the building. And 19 days later, when they left, we found the destroyed studios, equipment was stolen, computers were gone, and just shambles left.
Well, of course, the Israeli government has, in justifying its attacks on Palestinian television, the authorities' own television stations, has claimed that it was inciting the Palestinian people to further violence against Israel. What were you programming at the time, and what was could you tell us a little bit about the kind of programming that you do compared to the commercial stations or even the Palestinian Authority stations?
Well, our station is a private independent station. It's not affiliated with any political group or the Palestinian Authority, and obviously not the Israelis. And so we do public service work. In fact, at the time when we were closed, a lot of the work we were doing had to do with trying to calm the fears and trauma the children were facing because of the shelling of the Israelis. And we had worked with UNICEF to create 13 spots that aimed at really helping parents and children deal with the terrible trauma that was facing them. So we are not affiliated with the Palestinian Authority, but having said that, I still think it was a terrible crime to destroy an official Palestinian station that represented Palestinian culture and heritage, even if the Israelis claim that it was inciting, a claim that is questionable. I mean, in times of conflict, people are more patriotic, and television becomes less, if you will, neutral. But Palestinian television is seen by less than 10% of Palestinians. People were watching more Israel TV than they were Palestinian TV. And the claim that it was incitement that caused all the violence has been disproved because, you know, they destroyed the Palestinian TV months ago and the violence hasn't stopped. So these are just excuses that try to justify the continuation of occupation and colonization of our country. And, you know, I think they're just... there are justifications that you really can't prove, and they are just excuses to continue the situation that we have.
Could you tell us a little bit about the television and radio in the West Bank? I understand there's many, that's 50 different radio and television stations.
Until 1994, Palestinians had not experienced their own electronic media. We've never had our own radio or TV stations. But as a result of the Oslo Agreement, the Israelis officially allowed a national radio and a national TV station that became part of the Palestinian Authority. Local community radio and TV spread out actually almost uncontrolled. People literally put up an antenna like many people around the world, and they just started broadcasting. And because the Palestinian Authority had control over the cities, who were very populated, and so local coverage or local broadcasting just to a small community area became very popular. And so that's why we have lots of stations, but in reality they're not strong radio or TV stations. They're mostly local community radio or TV stations.
And what happened to a lot of these stations? The report that was prepared on the events of April 2nd to 19th not only talks about your station, but also the reports of what happened to some of the other stations.
In Ramallah specifically, it's what we call a sledgehammer terrorism against Palestinian media. Literally, soldiers entered a number of radio stations, TV stations, and with a sledgehammer broke transmitters, broke CD players, threw tapes and CDs out of the windows, and they literally just destroyed equipment that are used. And these are all private commercial radio stations that play music and, you know, every now and then local news. So it was a destructive effort that really reflected a revenge and anger tactic rather than a kind of a, you know, organized policy decision. Never has there been any official statement by the Israeli government or the army against any of the stations that were destroyed. They never said this particular station, for example, our station and the others that were destroyed. There has never been any official statement or declaration or even a hint that we have done anything against the law or in what they call incitement. Yet we had this thing happen to us, and we've never heard an apology or certainly an attempt to replenish and pay us back for the destruction that their soldiers did to us.
And during the time that the station was occupied and off the air, did you attempt to reach out to the Israeli authorities?
Absolutely.
Or the army, asked them what was going on?
We were in almost daily contact. I spoke personally to the spokesman of the Israeli army. We spoke to the coordinator of the military in the West Bank. We spoke to all of them. And we spoke to them on two levels. Obviously, we wanted to go back on there and get back into our building. But we were also concerned that, you know, there will be destruction. And so they kept reassuring us, no, don't worry, nothing will be touched. We're just, you know, for operational reasons, we had to use your building. But we were concerned, I was concerned that even if nothing had happened then, that the last 5 minutes before soldiers leave buildings usually is when the most destruction happens. So I was asking them and pleading with them, please make sure the soldiers, when they leave, they don't make that last-minute destruction. And all our efforts went to vain because they left 6 o'clock in the morning, and 2 hours later when we were able to get in after the curfew was lifted, we just found our building in just complete destruction, dirt, and signs, graffiti signs on the walls were just terrible.
Can you tell us about some of that graffiti?
They had things like, eat, instructions, that was the sign in Hebrew, instructions, eat, drink, and destroy. This was on our main bulletin board that was written in Hebrew. They had things like, this is the cost of terrorism, this is the punishment for terrorism, Palestine never, Arafat is crazy, things to that effect. There were a lot of anti-Palestinian graffiti, and to me, that reflects a kind of official turning a blind eye to what was happening, even if let us say the senior officer didn't know. The signs were in the middle of the building, and they walked by them every day. So it gave the kind of impression that go ahead and do whatever you want.
In a presentation I heard you make recently, you mentioned that the Israeli army actually used your own logbook to keep track of their own soldiers. So.
Yeah, when we entered our building, I don't know whether the soldiers had left in a hurry or whatever, but when we entered the building, we found that the main commander had been using our director's office, which, I mean, that's normal. It's in the highest top floor and had more phones than others. But our logbook for the staff to come and go on, they use the same logbook for their own soldiers and different units. The unit in our building was the engineering unit, which, you know, I mean, it shows the kind of unit that had. And they recorded for their own internal sake where soldiers went, which day, which hour, which units, and they left that back. So if one day there will be a kind of a war crime tribunal, we will know exactly which soldiers did which destruction.
And you had not only stuff destroyed, but quite a few things that were actually stolen, weren't you?
Our biggest loss has been the loss of our broadcast cameras. So we have 6 cameras that were looted, 12 computers. Many of them were brand new that had come as a project to teach people how to do graphic design. We had purchased this as a gift from the Danish government. We had a satellite dish and receiver that was contributed to us by the U.S. government, believe it or not, that was also stolen. U.S. consulate came, visited us, and said, "We'll replace it for you." But it shows you that how widespread and how Palestinians of all natures, Palestinians, whether they're moderate or radical, whether they support peace process or they're opposed to suicide bombings, we were all treated in the same way, and we were treated all in an inhuman and demonizing way.
In terms of, I understand that one station. One TV station, when the Israeli soldiers came in, they actually started broadcasting pornographic films.
You know, the Israeli army and government represents what they are doing as a fight against terror. And, you know, the day before they occupied our building, they had occupied a local TV station called Watan TV. And apparently what they did, they literally looked on the satellite dish to find one of the pornographic stations, and they hooked it up to their transmitter, and they started broadcasting in the middle of the daytime, you know, to a station that basically is seen by many conservative families, pornographical material. And this was very scary to us because, you know, not everybody will understand that this was done by Israelis. So when the soldiers came to our building, our staff turned off the transmitter in fear that things like this might happen to us also.
Tell us about the children's programming that you've done. You pioneered actually a project with Sesame Street to deal within the context of the West Bank in Israel that was hailed as a real breakthrough in terms of merging the need to address children's program at the same time within the political context. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. The number of children in Palestine, as in most of the Arab world, are very huge. They're the majority of the population are under 20. So the direction of our television station is that we give children priority in all our issues. So we are doing a lot of effort to create new programming for children. In the Arab world, there's very few original programming created for children. So that's really a priority for us. After the Oslo Agreement was signed and the euphoria of the peace process, we were approached by Sesame Street, who wanted to do a co-production with Israel Educational Television and us to teach both our children issues of respect and tolerance and so on. And despite some early hesitation, we agreed after we basically said that we will do this on condition that we basically set the agenda. And for us, the agenda was we needed to use Sesame Street programming to teach our own children pride in their own culture and their own national identity, in their language, in their community, in their family. And we felt that after we did that, because we felt that was really missing, we would be able to to kind of hint and to speak about the idea of stretching out and understanding the other side, the Israelis and so on. So it was a very difficult process to actually finesse this goal, which really we insisted on, that we could not talk about tolerance to the Israelis until we had enough teaching to our own children about pride in their own culture. And in the end, you know, it worked out. We were able to produce a program that children really liked. They were, because I didn't want to teach children.
How did the program actually work?
It's very complicated because we created a Palestinian street that was full of Palestinian characters. We had our own kind of Big Bird and you know, Elmo, one is Karim and Hanin, and they spoke Arabic. They lived in a Palestinian street that looked like, you know, a village or a center of a village. And there were times when the Israeli Muppets would come and visit our... And we had a Palestinian living in Israel who was a doctor, who was like the bridge, who had a cousin living on the Shadar Simsim, the Palestinian street. And we had some episodes in which there was a meeting, and we were very careful to be cautious in these meetings because, you know, we wanted to have our feet planted on the ground. It had to be a realistic program people could really, children could believe in. Yet we wanted to be forward-looking. We wanted to talk about peace. So it was an attempt to do both, to be realistic without talking about checkposts, but also, you know, looking a little bit towards peace, but without being so much into dream world that people would not believe you.
What was the reaction both in Israel and the West Bank.
Lots of research was done about our project, and you know, very detailed research of Israeli children and Palestinian children, how they reacted. And in both communities, there was a change for the better. But the researchers found that Israeli children had changed more than Palestinian children. They had less stereotypical feelings after the program, and there was a discussion. We had a seminar about why. And my argument was, not only is Israel TV very powerful in its transmission and programs, but for Israeli children, Palestinian issues are more psychological issues, which you can deal with in a children's program because you're only dealing with mental issues. But for Palestinians, Israel is not only a psychological issue, but it was also a physical issue. This Israeli soldiers are still, you know, on checkposts, and they were still part of our problem. And so it was very difficult to get Palestinians to really change dramatically their opinions of the Israelis while the soldiers were still there. And that's why I think that we have to be careful to make sure that talking about peace does not replace making peace. There has to be real peace first. And then a program like Sesame Street can actually be like the oxygen that gives people, you know, more energy. But by itself, you can't, you know, have peace just by a program on television.
So we want to thank you very much. And that does it for today's show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, and Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. You can go to our website at www.democracynow.org, and you can email us at mail@democracynow.org. And that's mail@democracynow.org. I'm Juan Gonzalez with Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!